that I'm guessing that you are wrestling with there is that we've somehow gotten ourselves in, we've convinced ourselves that when it comes to addressing both moralistic therapeutic deism or the gospel, that there are only two options. There is being the nun or there's being the mom. And we don't want to be either one of those things. And so that leaves us paralyzed somewhere in the middle. I'm hoping we can kind of get past that paralysis a little bit this afternoon. These are like the two ugly ditches of Christian life, right? The rigidity on the one hand and the having absolutely no substance whatsoever on the other hand, you know. But somewhere in between those two, and probably in a conversation between those two, is something that we can use. Let me tell you what happens when I usually talk to people about groups of pastors about moralistic therapeutic deism. Usually what happens is something like this. After we go through what it involves, a pall falls over the room. Nobody disputes it much, but nobody really has any ideas on what to do with it. And I'm not here to fix it, because I don't know how to fix it either. I inevitably feel like that story in Luke of the rich young man, only in Luke is he young, you know, who sneaks out to go visit Jesus, you know, in the middle of the night and ask, what must I do to be saved, right? And, you know, his approach is exactly like ours. He asked Jesus, what must I do to have eternal life? He wants to get the goods out of religion. He wants to know what he must do so that he can get what has been promised to him. You know, it's the same thing we do. It's the same reason we come to conferences like this. We want to know what we must do so that the young people we love can have the eternal life God has promised to them. It's a natural human impulse, and to want to know what the benefits of religion are to us. And, of course, you know what Jesus told him? Sell all your goods and follow me. Right? And it wasn't a judgment, it was a statement of fact. If you do this, you will have the life you want, the life that you're seeking. Why do you spend your money on that which is not bread? You know, he basically is saying to the rich young man, leave the things that are dragging you down and follow me. And of course, what happens? The rich young ruler can't do it, you know? And he realized, see what happens, he realized that in order to get this thing that God has promised him, it's going to cause him to do something so drastic, it's going to change his life. The text tells us he goes away sad. Yeah. And I think that happens to us a lot when we get hung up on the whole moralistic therapeutic deism thing. If we're going to be a healthy church, and by healthy I take that to mean faithful to the way of Jesus, it's going to take something that will change our lives forever. And that is such a daunting proposition that it makes me just want to give up and go to the beach. You know, I mean, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to make it better for young people without changing the church from top to bottom, which I am completely not only not capable of doing, but not called to do. So what am I supposed to do? It's paralyzing. You know? Am I the nun? Am I the mom? No, I'm not either of those things, but I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. Right? So we need to figure out what it is that will dislodge us from our comfort zone as a church, that will somehow rock our comfortable world, that will kind of turn the tables over a little bit. The thought of all of this is so daunting that we don't know where to begin, and so we feel stuck, right? We go away sad. I hope we don't go away sad this afternoon. I want to suggest two sources of hope that you already know. You don't have to write these down, you know these. Parents and congregation. You know, it is not for nothing that God has given us these structures in our life together, families and congregations. And I'm just briefly going to go through some slightly more concrete, we're not going to get down to the real nitty-gritty, and tell some stories about what this might look like. Okay? So the first thing, let's talk about parents. We said that parents matter most. I'm going to suggest churches matter too, but let's start with the parents. I think there are six of these. I didn't actually count them. But we know, as we mentioned before, that in the longitudinal studies, the religious devotion of parents matters enormously to the ongoing devotion of their children. So the very first thing parents have to do is invest in their own faith. We have to invest in our faith if we want kids to have their faith. It's a simple thing, but it's something that for some reason falls off the radar. I'm going to go through these kind of without a lot of discussion, and we can talk about them when we in a minute. The second thing is share what we love. We know this. We do this instinctively with our children. We share the things we love with them. Is Christ one of those things? Or is Christ somebody we share out of an obligation? You know, out of a sense of... I got guilt-ridden over this not long ago, when my daughter was a senior in high school. And I spent so much time with this study that it warped me forever. And I guess I wanted her to know that, you know, I do what I do, not because it's my job only, but because I love this. And I love serving God in this way. And she was like, yeah, I know. You know, really? How? And what she said was, and I didn't know this. She said, we live on campus, so students are in and out of our house all the time. And she said, yeah, because anytime your students are over, you laugh all the time. And I thought, well, that could be because my students are hilarious. But, you know, it's true. It's because but somehow she got the love part, which was enormously hopeful for me. Third, tell your children your faith story. Now, we're pretty good at remembering that young people need to hear the faith stories of others. We talked about testimony a minute ago. And so a lot of times as pastors or youth leaders, we orchestrate opportunities for other members of the congregation or maybe somebody else, you know, who's maybe even a celebrity, would tell their faith journey. That's all good. But research that's come out of the Fuller Youth Institute has shown that the most important faith story they need to hear is yours. The most important faith story young people need to hear is the faith stories of their parents. And, you know, the first time I heard this, I had a little faith crisis myself. I'm like, oh my gosh, when was the last time I told my children my own faith story? Do they know? Why did, you know, and why do I follow Jesus? Why do I do this? And it's easy to forget that we have that responsibility with our own kids. Now, what that means is parents need some practice in how to tell that story. They might need a chance to tell their story to each other first. That's not a bad thing to, you know, to have a bunch of parents together in a Sunday school class and to get in a small group. And the three turning points of your life of faith are, that's a non-threatening way to get at a faith journey, you know, kind of thing. Next. Okay, emphasize good news over good behavior. What do I mean by that? This also comes out of the research at Fuller. There is a very fine line between Christian being and Christian doing. And of the two of those, the being part is what really matters. If you believe that you belong to God rather than you just believe stuff about God, you have a much more durable faith as a result. So good news matters more than good behavior, particularly in the evangelical churches, at least in the United States. Being a Christian is often described by kids in terms of how they behave. You know, Christians are people who do X, Y, or Z, or who don't do X, Y, or Z, right? And so Fuller found is that young people who have this definition of faith, where they believe that faith is about behavior, are far more likely to discard that identity when they go to college than if they understand faith as being part of who they are. They asked these high school juniors what being a Christian meant. 30% of them did not mention Jesus Christ. These were evangelical high school kids. But they only mentioned behavior, and these were the kids most vulnerable to discarding that faith identity once they left high school. Fuller calls it the Jesus jacket. And so what happens is, if you think that being a Christian is about how you behave, Jesus becomes like an article of clothing you can put on, which is great, except it also means you can take it off. And so they would wear their Jesus jacket until they wanted to have sex with somebody, and then they would just take it off, do what they wanted, and then put the Jesus jacket back on again. And they saw no contradiction, because that's what you do with clothes. You put them on, you take them off. That's what you do, you know? And so that worked as long as religion was about your behavior. If it was about, you know, belonging to God, that was a whole different kind of thing. And anyway, the bottom line is they took the Jesus jacket off anytime they thought they were going to feel guilty about something. That solved it. Next, talk about faith at home. We've talked about the lack of theological language and some of the problems that accompany that. You don't learn a language unless you speak it. And you don't speak it unless you're in a community of people who speak it along with you. And almost all of us speak the language that is spoken at home. You know, that's our first language. That's the language we fall in love with. That's the language we can joke in. And that's our first language. It's the language spoken around the dinner table. Now, so the question that parents have to ask is, do we speak Christian around the dinner table? When I get a break that came my way at work, do I say, God really showed me God's grace, you know, when my boss overlooked whatever it was? Or do I say, oh, my boss gave me a break today? You know, it's just a matter of reframing real life events with the, you know, constructs of faith. Is being a Christian about being nice or about feeding more sheep? Anyway, the last one. Do one radical thing for your faith. In other words, take a risk for Jesus. And it's a risk that, you know, there's some consequence to. And do this in front of your children and explain to them that you're not doing it because you're a nice person. You're doing it because this is the way people who love Jesus act, you know? And, you know, you probably have stories in your life where somebody has done that unknowingly, witnessed what faith was like to you. I remember we have a holiday in the fall in the U.S. called Thanksgiving, and it's a big feast day, you probably heard about it, where families get together and everybody cooks more food than anybody needs. And when I was about 12, there was a homeless guy who knocked on my grandmother's door during our Thanksgiving meal. And she did not bat an eye, but she called him by name, Mr. Edwards, I'm so glad you're here. Like, come on in, we've got a seat right over here. She wasn't expecting him. But she didn't make a big deal about it, and she didn't go talking about how, you know, Christian this was of her to do that. But it was a pretty big act for her to take the stranger in and put him right beside us in the, you know, Thanksgiving dinner, which is holy time, you know, for a family. It made a big impression. This was how a woman who says she's a Christian acts. So do it in front of your kids and explain to them that you're doing it because you love Jesus, not because you're just that nice, okay? So what happens is we tend to avoid, you know, we're trying to avoid these ditches, right, between the rigid nun that we saw and the mom that doesn't have any way of articulating faith whatsoever. And so we wind up in this mealy-mouthed middle ground. Okay? My favorite example of how you get what that looks like is John Stewart. Do you know who John Stewart is with The Daily Show? Mm. Oh, this is going to get lost on you. Well, maybe the quote will be bad enough that you'll at least get it. He's a comedian who is actually, he reports news, hold that word loosely, because it's mostly for comedy's sake, but he's the number one source of news for young adults in the U.S. is through this comedy show called The Daily Show. But anyway, he made a slam against my denomination, which went like this. It's occurring to me, this may not translate cross-culturally. The United Methodist Church is the University of Phoenix of religions. The University of Phoenix is an online university that people don't think have a lot. You can get into it very easily. You know, there aren't a lot of barriers to your admission, so anybody's allowed in. Anybody can do anything. All you have to basically do is show up and you get your religious degree, is what he's saying. So this is not a slam against the University of Phoenix. It's a slam against the United Methodist Church. And it's because of that inability to move forward between, you know, the rigidity and the lax faith of the mom. Okay, so parents matter most, but churches matter too. So what would a church look like that enacts a missional imagination? So this is a story. You can just take heart that you're not alone as a parent, right? If you've got a community of faith that's willing to enact this along with you. And so this is a story about what this might look like if the congregation actually acted like the world that Jesus probably has in mind, and like people are the folks that God made us to be. And if you have not preached using this illustration, you might want to do it sometime. You know what American football is? Okay. Like, in Texas, American football is a religion. You know, it seriously is, it takes over everything. Everybody's aspiration in life is to be the high school football star. That's a slight exaggeration, but not by much. This is a true story that was reported by a Sports Illustrated sports writer of a football team in Grapevine, Texas. Grapevine, Texas is one of Money Magazine's most, you know, the best places to live in the U.S. The average income is about $100,000 a year. They have great schools that win all these awards, and one of those schools is called Faith Christian High School. It's a Christian school, which is not typical in the U.S., so it has a faith background to it. But the bottom line is, like every other high school in Texas, it takes its high school football seriously. And so Faith's football team, you know, consisted of, you know, just, I think they had like 60 players. They had all the best equipment, brand new stuff all the time, because it was just such a big deal. And they were a winning team going into November in 2009. They were 7-2, and they were about to play the Gainesville State Tornadoes. Okay? Gainesville State, on the other hand, was going into this game 0-8. That meant they had not won a single game. In fact, they had only made 2 touchdowns the entire season. Okay? They were not, in other words, good players. They wore old equipment, pretty dilapidated stuff. They basically were escorted to the locker room literally in handcuffs because there were only 14 of them on the team. Gainesville State is a juvenile detention maximum security prison, and it is located right outside of Dallas. So the Gainesville State Tornadoes play every game on the road. You know, they don't have any home games at the prison. And kids would get to Gainesville State by court order. In other words, they would have the they could choose to, you know, go behind bars or go to this juvenile detention facility. All right, so knowing this game was coming up, the coach has this idea. His name is Chris Hogan, and he says, okay, we've got all of these resources. What if just for one night we divide our fans in half and half of our fans cheer for the opposing team? And so the parents and fans agreed, yeah. Well, he sent out an email and he said, I want you to send this message. You are just as valuable as any other person on planet Earth. That's what the email said, and the fans agreed. So, on the night of the game, here's what happened. The Tornadoes took the field from Gainesville State, and they crashed through a banner that was made by the other team that said, Go Tornadoes. The Gainesville players, they found themselves running through this 40-foot spirit line of people cheering for them, calling them by name. They sat on these benches at the side of the field, and there was something behind them they'd never heard before. There were cheerleaders cheering for them because the coach had recruited the junior cheerleader squad to root for the opposing team. And so here's some of the quotes from the kids. Alex, who is the Gainesville lineman, said, I thought maybe they were confused. Gerald, who's another lineman, says, we can tell people are a little afraid of us when we come to the games, but these people were yelling for us by our names. And their quarterback was named Isaiah, and he said, I never thought I'd hear people cheering for us to hit their kids. But they wanted us to. All right, so at the end of the game, the Faith Christian High School wins the game, 33-14. But at the end of the game, this is the Gainesville State, the losing team, runs off the field with their fingers up in the air, number one, number one. It's like they had won the state championship. And they gave the coach the first Gatorade bath in history, probably for a 0-9 coach, somebody who'd never won a game. And then, because it was a Christian high school, they gather in the middle of the field to pray. And Isaiah, the Gainesville quarterback, says, I want to pray. Well, that made everybody nervous, right? So they didn't know what he was going to say. But there was a reporter there, so here's what he said. Lord, I don't know how this happened, so I don't know how to say thank you. But I never would have known there were so many people in the world who cared about us. And then the guards put the handcuffs back on him and escorted him back to the bus. and each of the kids got a bag of like a burger and fries and so on with a note from each of the faith Christian players, you know, to kind of wish them well on their way home. And what they said that when the bus starts to ride out, all of the kids on the bus, they go to one side of the bus to say, see all of these people saying goodbye, you know, like they're going home for Christmas or something. And before he got on the bus, the coach of Gainesville State turns around to the faith Christian coach and he grabs him by the shoulders and he said, "You will never know what your people did for these kids tonight. You will never, ever know." And that's when they went away. The sports writer who wrote about the story said, "It was rivers running uphill and cats petting dogs. Or as another Isaiah put it, the wolf shall live with the lamb, and the leopard shall live with the kid. Lie down with the kid, the calf and the lion and the fatling together, and a little child will lead them." Now, as you know, academics can deconstruct this story until there's not a chance the Holy Spirit had anything to do with it. But what's interesting is the next season, every team Gainesville State played did the same thing. You see, a missional imagination turns out to be contagious. It turns out that witness, I mean, these are not Christian schools that are doing this. They probably didn't pray at the end of the game, but they showed how to treat those kids like they were just as valuable as any other person on earth, you know, and it created this chain cycle. In fact, they went back and they re-reported the story because of the effect it had on the football circuit around Dallas. I don't think this is out of reach for what a missional congregation would do. I don't think this kind of, you know, rivers running uphill and cats petting dogs way of looking at the world is all that different from the world that Jesus had in mind when he turned over those tables in the first place. Miss no opportunity to change the rules of the game as a Christian, to be apostles of possibility, to be people who don't worry about death being on the horizon right there, to be fearful that we are in danger of dying. It's hard to get more radical than that. And what's more, I think if we could get that right, we might have a chance of combating these self-serving spiritualities like moralistic therapeutic deism.